Right. So, so my good friend Ibarz Uçkun, who is not from around here, we met when I was up in the up at the synagogue when we were stationed up in New Jersey. We met. We were talking the other day, and he says, "We've known each other almost 18 years." I said, "Yeah, it's hard to believe." And he's, and then all this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's because there has been a separation since 09, right? And and right when I left, his firstborn, Max, was born, and I got to go to his circumcision. And I always tell everybody that was the probably one of the most powerful spiritual things. He wasn't even my son, and I'm up here going, you know, just because of how, you know, powerful the spiritual principles and things that are being laid out. So it was very, very powerful. And we shared a lot of good memories in the 4 years that we hung out together up there. He was the youth director at the synagogue up there. He was on the worship team. He's the one that actually got me playing the djembe, you know, because I jumped up there and started playing, you know. I was like, well, I used to be able to keep a beat in high school on some drums, and so, you know, so it's his fault. So that's why I play on the box and all that now. And then he'll share, I'm assuming, probably a little bit more than what I'm saying, but then about 10 years ago is when you moved out west? Yeah, so then he went out and he was the assistant rabbi at a congregation out there, and he's since stepped down to be doing this ministry that he's going to be talking about. So today he's going to talk a little bit about his history, his transformation, because he was a Muslim. You know, I don't ever tell you this, you know, I had to put you on my security paperwork, right? Even though he's been in America longer, huh? Right, yeah. So when you, you know, you tell people that, you know, you got a friend, even though he was born in Turkey, and he came here when he was 5 months old, I think is what it was. And still, when you tell people that you know, in the military, you have a friend who's of Afghan Turkish origin, they get a little nervous. Yeah, it's like, no, he's an American. You know, you can let go of the other stuff. It's like, no, he was born overseas. So anyhow, that's the way they be. But anyhow, so he's one of my best good friends, as Forrest Gump would say. We always pick right up wherever we left off, and anytime we just need to have an argument about something, we just pick up the phone and talk. It's just, it's one of those good, mean-spirited, oh, wait a minute, I mean gentle-spirited, fun conversations, because we just like to debate, talk about the Word of God, talk about politics, talk about anything, and just catch up. And we could literally have a conversation, go, hey, man, I got to go, call him back 6 months later, we could pick up right where he left. So just one of those good lifelong friends. So without further ado, here's Ibarz. Oh, I do have to say, you can only believe half of what he says about me. Right, only half of it.
I just want to be clear that most of what Steve said is true. We have this gift, right? It's him and I. If I had to like put our relationship status on Facebook, you know how on Facebook and other social media places you can put like your relationship status? Him and I would be complicated. Our relationship status is complicated because, you know, we're good friends and all of the things that he said are true. Like, you know, we get along, we can pick up whenever, but I don't think you've actually had like a real like frank discussion with Steve until you make that little vein in his head pop out. Then I know I won. And I just want to, you know, take a minute here, just embellish me here for a minute. When he left New Jersey, he gave me a parting gift. And I think this kind of sums up our relationship. The first slide, am I doing this right? Is it on? On. First slide. Okay. He gave me this mug, one of the mugs that you can write on and write messages on. And he wrote, "I miss Steve," because he wanted me to remember that I would miss him when he was gone. Right? And, you know, knock, knock is a little inside joke I can't repeat here. And it says I need on the bottom. Next slide. A chocolate block, that's his favorite beer. And it says, let me ask you a question, because I'm from New Jersey, right? So, you know, when we get heated in discussions, we go, let me ask you a question. right? And the accent will come out. But I think that this last one really sums it up. You're right, Ibarz. And you got to understand the context in which he says it. It's more of like disgust. It's more of like, just tired of talking to him. So I think we could debate on whether or not, like for hours, whether the sky is blue or not. But Steve, it actually is blue. Just, you know, in case we get into it right now. But seriously, all kidding aside, Steve is a dear friend and a great leader. And I think that you guys are very blessed to have him. When he left New Jersey, I would have loved if he had stuck around and we had continued to build that community there in New Jersey. I could, you know, have seen a day where he would have been an elder, but I saw God calling him back here to Central Arkansas. The time that we spent together in my home, his family had went back ahead at the end of his deployment, and we spent a lot of hours talking theology, talking messianic theology, talking about the Word of God, all of the things, politics, while we were busting holes in my basement, right, getting it ready for the baby to come. So I just think you're in great hands with Steve, and, you know, you should all just, like, appreciate him. He invited me here to tell you a little bit about myself today and the ministry that I serve with, the Almeida Initiative. I'm married. I have 6 kids. Okay, so this is my family. I left my laser pointer in my bag, but the fellow in the Eagles jersey, go Eagles, we're going to win tomorrow, is my oldest. His name is Max. The fellow in the red shirt and the girl on the end are my 11-year-old twins, Jackson and Emine. And the girl in white next to my wife is Abigail. She's 9. And the 2 other girls are Nora and Ruby. They are also twins. So we had twins twice, and hence the white hair. I used to serve at Beth Zion Synagogue with Rabbi Jan Rosenberg. And that's where I met Steve. And after 15 years there, my wife and I started going through this process of feeling like the Lord had more for us, that he wanted us to move on from this place and go do something else. And, you know, I was the one who would always say, I'm going to die in New Jersey, right? Like, you're going to bury me here. A lot of Jerseyites are really like that. But God had stirred up my heart and started putting, you know, a vision of something else in our lives. So we moved to Seattle, because that's where God was opening the doors, but it didn't hurt that my in-laws are all from Seattle. My wife is from Seattle. You know, they wanted to see their grandchildren. We wanted them to be around their grandparents and meet all their cousins. When I got to Seattle for a short time, I was the worship leader at Restoration Synagogue, but they figured out I couldn't sing. So they decided, I mean, I play like 3 instruments, but I can't sing. They promoted me to assistant rabbi, and I did that job for 7 years, and I really enjoyed it. I felt like, you know, I had this great opportunity to disciple people. That's where my heart is. My heart is for discipleship. My heart is to raise up the foundations of many generations. Is a, you know, le dor vador is something we talk about in Judaism. But my heart started stirring again. God started putting on my heart that there was another change, another transition coming. And, you know, I didn't want to go this time. I just felt like I'm going to kind of double down and wait because I don't really know what God is saying. So in order for me to explain to you where I wound up, I think it's important for me to explain where I started. The question people ask me a lot is, what would cause you to stop doing like messianic ministry, and why would you go work for something with a Muslim name, right? Well, the truth is, like Steve said, I used to be Muslim. My testimony kind of is the story of, it starts with my dad. Hold on 1 sec. It starts with my father. So my dad was born in Ankhoy, Afghanistan in 1927. They were simple people, they were poor, they were shepherds. They made things, and they would get up on camel caravans, and my father would ride these caravans all over Afghanistan, and they would trade, right? They would trade for, you know, the things we made for your grain. As he got older, he got more involved in politics. And now his stances were essentially stances that you and I take for granted, like more democracy, more individual rights, having each person having the ability to express their political voice, and for a more modern Afghanistan. And you know, my father was a great speaker. He was much better than I ever was. And he had a great following. His words, you know, gained traction. But his efforts also gained the attention of the then king of Afghanistan. His name is Zahir Shah. So if you were alive around 9/11, some of you would remember that Zahir Shah was somebody that we tried to reinstall to lead Afghanistan, but the people, you know, rejected him in their election. So my dad's voice caught so many people's ears that the regime of the king began to persecute him. They started putting him in places where his voice would be marginalized. My father's from northern Afghanistan. That makes him an Uzbek. So the Uzbeks were, you know, in 9/11 terms, you would understand them as the people who formed the Northern Alliance, right? The Northern Alliance pushed back against the Taliban. So they moved my father in the south, where Pashtun people and Hazara people were. And, you know, they were trying to get my father to not be heard. It didn't work. My father, you know, still managed to garner up enough attention to be a problem for them. He applied to medical school and he was denied. You know, they wouldn't let him become a doctor, so they let him be a teacher so they could control where he was going. So their attempts to minimize his voice failed. His effectiveness as a communicator didn't. And he still wrote and still traveled all throughout the country, trying to keep in contact with people who supported him. Eventually, Zahir Shah put a price on my father's head, essentially a bounty. And when that happened, my dad was in his hometown. So my dad, you know, kind of was brought in front of everybody. And they said, "We're supposed to kill you, but we're afraid of your brother." Now, my uncle was like a gangster, right? He had a gang. You know, they were wild people. They ran around with guns, and they didn't want to cross him. So they said, "We'll give you essentially a 24-hour head start." So my father grabbed what little he could with him. My father had adopted a student of his. My dad was a teacher. And two of his friends, and they lit out for the Pakistan border. So they crossed the mountains in between Afghanistan and Pakistan on foot with nothing but the clothes on their back. They didn't have shoes. My mother told me that they were wrapping their feet in bags and leaves and anything else that they could. They went village to village, you know, trying to rely on the Islamic kindness that's expressed towards strangers. So they would meet up with shepherds, and shepherds would say, "Come and spend the night." They hid from robbers. They, you know, fled for their lives a couple of times. And eventually, they wound up in Pakistan, where they applied for asylum. So they were denied, and my father and his friends essentially snuck in, right? They were at the border, they were denied, they went back up, and then went in through the back door and applied for refugee status. And they were denied that. So the next thing that my father and his friends decided to do was, let's just try and raise some money and figure out what the next step for us is. That next step was them smuggling themselves into Iran. They paid somebody to hide on a bus and hide them on a bus and get them across the border. And they tried the same process all over again. Let's see if we can get asylum here. Let's see if we can become refugees here. And again, they were denied. My father and his friends decided that they were gonna, you know, pool their resources, they were gonna stick together, and they were gonna give it one last try. So they bribed another bus driver to smuggle them into Turkey. So Uzbeks consider themselves Turks. They are, you know, leftovers of the Mongols, right? And the Mongols, you know, claim their heritage back to, you know, Central Asia, Afghanistan. So he smuggled himself in there, and he also applied birth status and was also denied. And him and a friend of his built a shed, actually, like on the corner of someone else's property. They were squatting. And they lived there for 2 years, doing odd jobs, you know, no power, no plumbing, no food, nothing. But my father was brilliant. He was a great speaker. He, you know, spoke five languages. He knew, you know, algebra and all kinds of science. And he eventually got a job as a teacher's assistant in the school where he met my mom. And when he met my mom, you know, she helped him. She's like 15 years younger than him. So he's kind of robbing the cradle a little bit. And she helped him with his application and all of this paperwork for his status. They eventually got married. My father, you know, my mother is like from Mongolian stock. My middle name is Han, right? So Han is the leftover of the Mongols, particularly our greatest descendant, Genghis Khan, right? And my mom is also like leftover Turkish Mongolian. So my dad said, I want to marry a pure Turk and you're it, right? So they hit it off, they got married, and eventually my father was granted citizenship in Turkey. There he had four kids, and I am the youngest. So how many of you paid attention to politics in the 70s, for those of you who are older? Okay, in the Middle East, the Soviets were trying to cause a lot of problems. And in the middle 70s, you know, what was happening is, I mean, if I can be political here, kind of similar to what's happening here. There's an effort to destabilize the government. And the things that are going on then mirror the things that are going on now. The Soviets would come in with their ideology. They would say, you're oppressed. They would arm them. They would organize them. They would give them money and they would give them drugs. And eventually the conflicts there got so violent that people were shooting each other in the streets. And my father said, we're not doing this again. So he started to look for a way out. And he applied you know, to go to Germany and France. There are a ton of Turks in Germany, ton of Turks in France, and also the United States, because everyone knows in America the streets are paved with gold, right? And one of his friends that he had left Afghanistan with had married a Turkish woman, and they immigrated to the United States. So that fellow's name was Mahmut Turkmen, and he came and, you know, sponsored us. So my parents left Turkey with four boys. I was 40 days old when we left. That's the minimum age, right, that you can move a baby in Islam. I was 40 days old when we left, and we had $2,000 in our pocket, and we went to Brooklyn, right, because that's where everybody winds up. And there, you know, my dad started to look for a job. He started looking for, like, what, you know, how can I provide for my family? And he found a job working where he had been working before. He worked for Mobil Oil in Turkey, and he wound up working for Mobil Oil in New Jersey. And while we were there, we were all growing up. You know, it was a learning process. My brothers were older when they came, so they had to learn English. We were definitely foreigners. We were definitely very different. We started in a little place called New Brunswick, near Rutgers University, and settled in Trenton, New Jersey. And in Trenton, New Jersey, I just want to let you know that in like the early, like late 70s, there are no Turkish people there. There are very few Muslims there. So we were alone. You know, you grow up in that environment feeling isolated. You feel like you can't really connect with everybody. You know, my best friends were Haitian and, you know, like white Americans and Hispanics. And, you know, you go to their house for dinner and they're cooking pork chops, right? And you're like, you can't eat them because you're like, well, we don't eat those things. And they look at you and they go, why? And you go, because we're Muslim. And they go, what, don't you like the food? And I'm like, I gotta go. And eventually, you know, as that kind of progresses, you start feeling isolated. Actually, the word I like is alienation. You start feeling alienated from everyone else. You start feeling like you don't fit. Everyone else has their place and their people, but you don't fit. You don't have a people to be with. You don't have a place to go. And, you know, I didn't even feel like I fit among my own people. On the weekends, we would drive up to Brooklyn, you know, and meet with other Turks and other Afghans. And I didn't fit in with them either because I didn't speak Pashto. I didn't speak any Arabic. I didn't speak any Persian. And I barely spoke Turkish. So I would sit there kind of going, this is so boring, Dad. Wait a minute, I just channeled my son. And, you know, kind of hated being around these people because I just wanted to be back home and I wanted to be with my friends because I didn't fit in with them, but I really didn't fit in over here. So that was our childhood. Now, how many of you have teenagers? Yeah, or have had teenagers at one point? Yeah, see, what happens when you're a teenager and you feel isolated and alienated is you start acting out. You start looking for ways to say, listen, I don't fit in. I got to find my people. For me, that was in athletics. So I played football. I wrestled. And that worked for a long time in high school. You know, I wasn't any good, but I did it. And, you know, it was how I made my friends. They were my people. They were my tribe, right? The jocks. Eventually, my senior year came around, and I was looking forward to doing what all kids want to do who are athletes. I'm going to have my senior year. This is going to be great. I actually wasn't terrible at football, and I was talking about walking on at a university in, like, western Pennsylvania called Juanita University. You know, I called them. They said, you can walk on. You can try out. So I was really psyched about it. My guidance counselor, who was setting my schedule, you know, we were talking about, well, like, how to fill out my schedule for that senior year, and she wanted me to take, I don't know, something like home ec or something like that. And I wish I kind of had taken that because I love to cook now, but I didn't realize it back then. And I said no, so she gave me a study hall. So I show up for the first day of football camp, and they say, you can't participate because you're academically ineligible. I said, well, can't you do anything about it? And, you know, there was no, like, movement to do anything about it for me because my parents were immigrants. You know, my brothers had been through that school. They all hated my brothers, right? Because my brothers were, you know, acting out in troublemakers. I was a good kid. I was, you know, on the football team, right? I was an athlete. I was participating and being a part of the school, but I was ineligible. So in that state of losing my people, losing my tribe, I started looking for another tribe. All of my friends wound up going to college, and all I was left with were, you know, people who live in Central Jersey, right? And the ones that I fit in the most, I found, were the ones who did drugs. So I started experimenting with, you know, first marijuana, then, you know, people would come up with some LSD or some other hallucinogen or something like that. And, you know, I wound up getting a job at Princeton University when I was 20 years old. I worked as a maintenance painter there for 15 years. But I had a good job, and I made good money, and I had a lot of time to kill, and I had these friends who liked to party. So I would party with them, and I would start doing drugs with them, and I had a beeper, and people would call me, and I'd like be like, the party's going to be at, you know, Eddie's house, right? And I would coordinate the parties, and I had money for drugs, so sometimes I would buy some, and I would sell them, and I would sell the drugs to my friends, and I'd be like, oh, I'm just going to make enough money to get my money back. I just made a little bit more, but the point was to always stay high. The point was always to stay on drugs. And, you know, I started getting more and more interested in music, right? So I picked up a guitar, and I started to learn how to play the guitar, and I wanted to be in a band, and I wanted to be a rock star. Back in the 90s, some of you might remember, the, you know, big bands were like, that's when we first figured out who Pearl Jam was. I liked Metallica, I liked Led Zeppelin, I liked heavier music, and I wanted to kind of make that music, just like all my friends were. The problem with that is, first of all, I'm not talented enough to be a professional musician. Second of all, if you live that kind of lifestyle, it has its consequences. There's a bill to be paid at the end of that. And more that I pursued that lifestyle, the more and more I had to pay those bills. I lost all of the friends that I had who were not doing that. All of the friends that I had who were athletes and academics who had gone on to college. In a weird way, I became even more alienated from the world around me because I had given myself over to these substances that I was doing all of the time. You know, I can fast forward to, like, when I was 23 years old, And my moment of truth happened when I was in the Trenton City lockup, handcuffed to a bench, high as a kite. I'd been looking for, you know, drugs, and I got caught in a sting. And they took me to jail, and they handcuffed me to the bench. And I remember passing out and waking up and passing out and waking up, waiting for them to process me. And I always got to, like, gauge the room when I tell this part of the story. So I woke up, and there was a transvestite prostitute next to me wearing, like, a blonde, like, curly Goldilocks wig, like, staring at me and making eyes at me and, you know, kind of making overtures. And I'm like, oh, my God, am I going to get locked up in a room with this guy? You know, they say, like, when you're in trouble, you start calling on the name of the Lord. I started calling on the name of the Lord. I started saying, God, please don't let me be locked up in a room with that guy, because I don't want that to happen. And I would, you know, pass out again, and he would still be there. And I would wake up, and I'd go, oh, my God, please get me out of here. Please get me out of here. And eventually, you know, I did spend the night in jail, but we weren't together, thank God. And long and the short of it is, when I walked out of that jail, I remember thinking to myself, I can't stop. I can't stop doing these things. I didn't have control over my ability to do, to not do drugs. And I realized in that moment that if I kept going that way, I would die. And I distinctly remember walking out into the parking lot, thinking two things. I got to get to work. And God, please help me. And that kind of started opening up a different, maybe a part of my heart that I had locked away a long time ago, the part of me that was like curious about things like religion. My father sent me to Catholic school through first through fifth grade, and I had this great relationship with the priests, where I would, you know, ask them about religion, and we would have these discussions and stuff like that. I would you know, visit them. I know the Catholic Church is getting like a, you know, had gone a completely different direction right now, but I had a good experience, and they would tell me about Jesus. And I would go and I would tell my father about Jesus, and my father would say, you can't do that because we're Muslim. You're Turkish, and all Turks are Muslims. That's why we don't do that. And he would explain to me from an Islamic perspective why Jesus wasn't God. So I started searching. I opened that part of my heart back up, and I started looking for answers, and I started reading books about world religions. I have a tattoo on my arm. I can't show you right now because it's all covered up, but it's a tattoo of a yin-yang. Are you familiar with the yin-yang? A yin-yang sun. I created my own religion. it's a yin-yang with, like, you know, little triangles around it to make it look like a sun. And to me, there was light, and there was darkness, and there was energy. And I realized that there was light and darkness. So, you know, in the light, there's a little bit of good, right? In the darkness, there's a little bit of good. And in the light, there's a little bit of bad. And that was me, right? The two sides of myself fighting back and forth. So introduced, like, illicit drugs into it, and I created my own religion I like to call transcendental pharmaceuticalism. So that was my starting point in looking for answers. The transcendental pharmaceuticalism thing didn't pan out. So I started looking for more, you know, for more. I started looking for answers, and I explored Eastern religions. I started reading up on Buddhism and the concepts of Zen, and it didn't fit with me. Because of what I had gone through, because of the nearness of my problems, I felt like I couldn't really connect with this idea that my ancestors were going to help me, that I was going to pray to an ancestor, or that I was going to try and meditate my way to a place of feeling, like, absolved of the guilt that I felt. So I started studying Hinduism, and eventually I made my way back to Christianity and Judaism and Islam, right? Because I came to the conclusion that there was a God. I came to the conclusion that I believed in a God. Because who had I cried out to in that jail cell? Who was I talking to? I wasn't talking to any of those other things, because they don't focus around a central power. So I started looking into answers, and And I, at the time, I was working at the university as a painter, and I had a supervisor who was a Baptist lay minister. And he was, you know, upright man of God, right? He went to an all African-American church in Trenton. And he would always, you know, kind of be like singing a praise song or something like that. Had a great spirit about him. And I said, Larry, what do you do with sin? And he said, well, you have to be forgiven of sin. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, you need Jesus. He said, you need Jesus to forgive your sin. You need to accept him as your savior, and he will forgive your sin. And I said, that's great. I can't do that because my dad will kill me. I absolutely can't do that. So that's what being a Christian was. I couldn't do it. I had other interactions with Christians throughout that time where I used to like to play basketball, but I played thug street basketball with academics. So I was like the king of fouling people. And I would do hard fouls, and these guys wouldn't, like, I was playing with were Christians at Princeton University Seminary, and they wouldn't get rattled. They wouldn't be like, well, you know, I'm going to throw punches at you. I thought they would, but they didn't. And I went up to him after, and I said, you know, you guys are different. Like, I just fouled you. I smacked you in the face while you were trying to shoot. Like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it, but, you know, why didn't you come at me, bro? And he said, because I'm a Christian. We're all Christians. We all study the Bible. And I said, oh, good. I got a religion. And I started telling them about that religion. They were like, okay, that's nice. So that thing that happened where I got in legal trouble actually got me in some serious trouble. And I was looking at doing some time. And I started, you know, really looking for answers. And I finally came clean to my father. I had kept it all a secret from my dad. They knew I was going out and, you know, they thought getting drunk, but I explained to him everything about the drug use. I explained to him everything about the legal trouble that I was in. And then I started asking him about God. And I started saying, Dad, you know, I don't understand. Like, I can't stop. And I know that there's a God and I'm looking for a God. I just don't know what it is. And he said, well, hold on a minute. I know people who can answer your questions, these imams, these Muslim imams, and they can tell you all of the answers to your questions. And, you know, if you want, you could train to be an imam. And I was like, this makes total sense to me. I should do this. I think that when people are in times of crisis in their lives, like particularly in their, you know, mid-20s, right, or whenever you come into crisis, I think for a lot of people it happens when you start having kids. You start asking yourself, what do I really believe? How am I going to raise these kids? I think you default back to whatever you were raised in as a starting point. So for me, that made perfect sense. My dad knew people. He was going to take care of it for me, and I was going to study to be an imam. But like we used to say at my former congregation, a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque. Again, my backup plan was to be a musician. So I was working with the first singer in my band. I mean, I still like to, you know, be creative. I was kind of in this period where I hadn't done any substances for 8 months. I was completely clean, and I was looking for a way out. And in that time period, my singer's girlfriend connected with her best friend from high school. They invited us both to dinner because they were trying to play matchmaker. And you know, we met and we talked, and I thought she was interesting. And then the next time we went out, they invited us to a bar. So we went to a bar in Trenton, and I offered to buy her a drink. Can I buy you a beer? And she said, I don't drink, I'm a Christian. Now listen, that's not like that's not an indictment against drinking. That was, you know, where she was in her walk at the time. And I said, well, I don't understand why that is. Can you explain what being a Christian is to me? And how many of you have ever seen Star Wars? Okay, so in Star Wars, whenever they're going to go from one place to another really fast, they do this thing called hyperspace, right? And, you know, you see the stars, and the stars all just kind of go, like, lit up, and you zoom past them. I felt like I was in, like, hyperspace. I don't remember what she said, but I felt like every word she said was alive and finding its way into my mind. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about her explanation of what Jesus was. Again, I had had a couple beers. Maybe that had something to do with it. But truth be told, I remember that conversation. I don't remember the details, but I remember some presence being there. I remember something happening, something that had never happened to me before. And it awoke in me a curiosity, and I wanted to talk to her more after that night. We wound up not seeing each other for a month. You know, I kept on calling my friend, and I'd be like, hey, man, because we used to actually have corded phones. Hey, man, you know, where's Bonnie? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, you know, you'll meet her. And I didn't have her number or anything like that. So eventually, they did another thing. They invited us over to their house. And afterward, I asked her out in the parking lot. I said, hey, would you like to go out sometime? And she said, okay, well, you can go to church with me. And honestly, you know, like, that sounds kind of trite, right? Like, okay, the heathen guy's looking to go out with a Christian girl, and she said, you can go to church with me. But I was actually interested. I really wanted to know what she was talking about. So I said, sure. A week goes by, and at the end of the week, she says, you know, I'll meet you at your apartment. And she shows up with chaperones. I had chaperones on my date with her. It was her friend, who was like super Pentecostal lady, and her husband, who was a seminary student. And I got in the car with them, and they took me to a Messianic congregation in Philadelphia known as Beth Yeshua. How many of you have ever heard of them? Okay, so I go to Beth Yeshua for the first time, and I have never seen anything like this before in my life. You know, I went to Catholic school, so I'm expecting pews, and the guy up there in the collar, you know, and you know, the big guy on the cross up in the front. And instead, people are blowing shofars, and that's a really, like, dance, like, that's like the origin of Messianic dance revolution, right? Like, the crazy dancing, like a circle, and then a circle on the outside, and you know, really up-tempo music, and I'm sitting there listening to it, and I'm like, this is all in a minor key. I kind of like this, you know? So, okay, the moment passes, and the rabbi gets up, and he starts to preach. You know, they turn the lights out in the sanctuary, and I am literally, like, we didn't have cell phones back in 1997. This is back in 1997, so I'm staring at the floor, right? And all I'm thinking about is she going to go to the diner with me after this is all done, right? Are we going to go out to the diner? And in the middle of his sermon, the rabbi says this one line. Saddam wants to destroy Tel Aviv. But Yeshua won't let him do that. And I was staring at the floor, and I thought to myself, who's Yeshua? And it was at that moment, I didn't even pick up my head. The lights were off in the room, but the lights came on around me. I was literally surrounded by light, and this thick presence drew close to me, a presence now that I understand to be the presence of God. And it came so close, and I just didn't, like, pick up my head because I knew I didn't want to look. And I felt him say, I'm Yeshua. And I didn't say anything. I just thought to myself, I'm coming. That was my response. I'm coming. And then it slowly started to recede, and the room started to come back to normal. And I was there sitting again, looking at the floor, wondering what had just happened to me. Their service ends, and their young people come up to us after and start asking us questions. One of them tried to steal my girlfriend. And she wasn't my girlfriend yet, but she would wind up being my girlfriend. And another one comes up to me and starts, you know, asking me questions like, hey, how long have you been a believer? And I instantly lied. And I said, oh, a couple weeks. And he knew I was lying. So his name is Ari Halbin. He's now a minister for Chosen People's Ministries. He pulls out the Bible and he starts talking to me. I said, well, you know, I was a Muslim. And he starts explaining to me about Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael. And he points me to Ephesians 5, talking about the unity of the bond of the Spirit. And then they told us about a Messianic congregation closer to my house in New Jersey called Beth Zion Messianic Synagogue in Jackson, New Jersey. About 2 weeks go by, and her and I go to go check out the service. This is mid-November in 1997. And I don't remember what he was talking about. I don't remember what he said, but I sat in that room, and I remember feeling like I'm home. This is where I belong. And afterward, how many of you listened to the music of Sue Samuel? Okay, so Sue and Brian were at that congregation at that time. And Brian comes up to me after the service and says, you know, what'd you think of the service? And I said, it was bleeping great. And then, you know, in the midst of our conversation, you know, I connected with him and I started connecting with others and I started feeling like I actually belong here. So 6 months goes by, the girl leaves, and I stay. And I stayed there for 15 years. And I became the youth leader. I was the young guy with the pickup truck, right? Like, you needed something moved, I had a pickup truck. That was a sweet truck, you remember that one. And eventually I became a shamashim. And we didn't actually like ever get to the process, but I became a de facto elder, right? We were in the process of choosing elders, but then that's when God started to open my heart and start to call us towards Seattle. And then when we moved to Seattle, I didn't like want to go into ministry anymore. I'd kind of given up at that point. I was kind of burnt out from being a youth leader and, you know, being in a small, like, life in a small congregation and ministry in a small congregation. But the Lord opened the door to be able to become the assistant rabbi at Restoration, which I did for 7 years. So that leads us up to this past January. I was getting ready to go on sabbatical. We had that built into our contracts, our hiring agreement, that I was going to get a sabbatical every 7 years. And I was getting ready to go on my first sabbatical, and God started to poke at me a little bit. Right before that, the fall of Afghanistan had happened. Now, when I was growing up, when the Taliban came through Afghanistan in the early 90s, we started trying to bring refugees over. Those guys are my friends. I grew up with them. They're my cousins. You know, to this day, I still think of them as my cousins. And they would tell me the stories of what happened when they left. My one cousin had to shave his head to make himself look ugly to the Taliban so they wouldn't rape him. My father told the story of how, actually, he didn't tell me the story. I got the details later, but one day we got a phone call, and my father just, like, that was the day he died. He didn't die that moment, but a part of him died. The Taliban had come in and killed everyone in his village. They killed the men and the women and the children. They raped the women and the children in front of the men, and then they killed the women and the children in front of the men, and then they took some of the men and they peeled their skin off alive and threw them out in the street and allowed the dogs to eat them. And then they kept a couple of the men that they didn't kill, and they took their eyes out and they cut off one hand and one foot, opposing, like it says to do in the Quran, to infidels, but left their tongues so that they would tell anyone who came through who did it. I wasn't a kid anymore. This happened when I was in my 20s, but it formed my adulthood. I watched my father, essentially, like his hair turned white after that. That was when his heart problems started getting the better of him. Took the life out of it. And, you know, I could move on from that moment because I had this messianic community that I was invested in. And, you know, it was kind of weird because I was like the ex-Muslim, former Muslim. I think what we used to say in Seattle was, I'm the first former Muslim, Afghani, Turkish, Mongolian rabbi ever, right? Messianic rabbi. I can't speak for non-messianic rabbis. And when the fall of Afghanistan happened and I saw these people hanging off the side of planes and throwing their babies over barbed wire fences. Now listen, I need you to understand this. My heart broke. It broke like an egg. And what came out of that egg was a powerful love for my people that I had never experienced before. Excuse me. And listen, I was raised by Muslims. My mother's a Muslim. My father's a Muslim. All my brothers are Muslims. All my relatives in Turkey are Muslims. I was raised around Muslims, but I experienced the love of God and the compassion of God for these people in a way that I had never experienced it before. And it wasn't like a, you know, in the book of Isaiah where the Lord appears to Isaiah and says, "Who will go for us?" And Isaiah says, "I'll go." It wasn't even like that. I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would watch the news and I would say, "I'll go. Send me. Someone has to be there for these people." And I didn't know it at the time, but God heard that prayer. And that's when I started to get connected with the Al-Maida Initiative. Dramatic pause. Oh, did it? Can we go to slide 5? The next one, the Al-Maida Initiative. So the Al-Maida Initiative is a 501c3 that operates out of Seattle. And as a Messianic rabbi, the leader of the Al-Maida Initiative, James Raymond, came to one of my pastor's groups and started talking about this ministry that he had towards Muslims. I said, "Oh, that's interesting. I used to be a Muslim. Let's talk." So they would give me these phone calls and they'd be like, "Hey, do you want to go meet a Muslim?" And I'd be like, "Okay, great, let me go." And I would hop in the car and I met a woman called the First Lady of ISIS, right? Her husband was the most successful American jihadi ever. There are articles about her in The New Yorker, and the Discovery Channel recently just did a documentary on her as well. I met her son and explained to him that it's not okay for you to want the Jewish people to commit self-genocide because they're not keeping the laws of the Bible. And then I met his mom a couple months later and explain to her that the love of God surpasses even your sins, even your involvement in ISIS. I had these great conversations and I felt like they were energizing me. And then I just kind of started doing more and more with them. They invited me to do a podcast. And right before I went on my sabbatical, I felt like the Lord was saying, "It's time to leave Restoration and step down as being a rabbi." And I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." Yeah, it doesn't work. And I didn't want to do that, but I did want to do it because I realized what he was calling me into. I took a bunch of baby steps towards it. While I was on sabbatical, I went to go visit my mother who lives in Turkey, and I just got convicted about how much low-hanging fruit there is in the Muslim world, particularly in a place like Turkey. It's like a secular country. Muslims don't even know why they're Muslim. They're just Muslim. Because they're told, like I was, that you're Muslim. You're Turkish, so you're Muslim. And Turkey is 98% ethnic Turk. And all of that 98%, there's a small minority of them that are Christians or Jews. The rest of them are all Muslims. And they don't know why. Some of them do, but it's not like they sit around reading the Quran because they can't read it because it's in Arabic. So when I got invited to be a part of Al-Maida, they offered to bring me on as the coordinator of Afghan outreach, and that is what I do now. So one of the things that we do is we teach this thing called Al-Maida University, where we do a 101 and a 102 level class. And with this class, you know, we teach in 101 like the basics of the Muslim worldview. Some of the history of Islam, why Islam looks like it does today, and how a younger Muslim would think about it, right? Like, who are the people in her life? What is her crazy uncle like? right? How does that affect how she views Islam? What is her mother like? What is her father like? In the 102 session, we start talking about evangelism techniques, where we start encouraging people to be able to go and make friendship with Muslims, where to find them, how to connect with them, how to talk to them in a way that isn't scripted. How to, you know, not whip out a pamphlet and say, well, these are the four spiritual laws, and Jesus told me to give this to you. And they're going to be like, that's weird, go away. Those approaches don't work. So that's one of the things we do. This was at a conference called Love for Muslims in New York City. We were invited, and in a roundabout way, it was kind of messianic because we wound up doing it in Chosen People's building, right? Like, it's a long story. We also equip and educate churches, right? So when we talk about educating churches, we do the 101 and the 102, but we kind of meet with believers and encourage them to be bold in their faith in a way that Muslims can understand, right? Not to come on super strong, not to, you know, go right to the Bible. It doesn't work with Jewish people either, by the way. In all the years of ministry that I did to Jewish people, to just come at them with the New Testament and be like, well, you're wrong. You know, the way you practice everything that's about your heritage is disconnected. It equally doesn't work with Muslims. They have a different coming onboarding point where Muslims actually believe that Jesus existed, but they believe he was a prophet. They don't believe that he was resurrected. They don't believe that he's the Son of God. They're disconnected with the Trinity. You know, we believe God to be Echad, right? One God. Compound unity, composite unity. They think, when we talk about Trinity, that Jesus is the product of a sexual relationship between God and Mary, right? So it's hard for them to wrap their heads around that, but that's not what we're talking about. A lot of what we do in equipping and educating Christians is kind of what I do now, as what I did as a Messianic rabbi, pointing them back to the context of the scripture, pointing them to this idea that there's this unbroken chain of scripture that is here, and it's a wealth of knowledge for you to be able to insert into your Christianity and help you grow as a believer and get you to the point where you can talk to a Muslim about what's going on in their lives. So then that way, when they come at you with like, well, what about Jesus being the product of, you know, a sexual relationship between God and Mary, you could say, that's not true, and here's why. Right? I'm not having great luck with the clicker. We also teach them to engage. So this is at a students' dinner for a ministry called Open Doors. And this is at an iftar dinner. How many are familiar with Ramadan or iftar? Right? This is a period of fasting that Muslims do. Ramadan is at the beginning. Iftar is at the end. They fast for this period of time. From sundown to sunset, and then at the end of the night, they gorge themselves. It's actually kind of cool. The food is fantastic. And they gather at the beginning of the holidays. They're considered holy times. And what we do is we host these dinners where we invite Christians and Muslims to come to this iftar dinner or this Ramadan dinner, and we encourage them to have conversations with each other. Like real conversations. So listen, we're not syncretic. We're not talking about this idea that there's a Chrislam and that, you know, we're worshiping the same God. We're doing the absolute opposite. We're telling them that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Yeshua is the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through him. And this is what we believe. But tell us what you believe. Explain to us what you believe. And we get into these great conversations that have depth and meaning, because we've kind of stepped out of this box of we can't talk to Muslims or we can't interact with them in their own terms. We've spent the past 6 years studying the source materials. We've read, right now as a staff, we're reading the Quran every Monday and going through it and talking about it with the staff and explaining, like, well, you know, this is kind of weird because this seems out of step with the Bible, and here's why, right? We're training our staff to be able to understand their arguments and to answer them from a biblical point of view. So we also do a podcast. We do two podcasts, actually. The first podcast is called the Almeida Podcast. I was like the final guest we kind of put this on the shelf for a little while, but it is a great source of information. It's essentially us engaging Muslims, right? Just talking to Muslims about Muslim issues. You can see that we talked to, the different topics. The top one was all about Afghanistan, but we've talked to people who escaped Afghanistan. We've talked to imams about, we got a series on there called Pork Wars. It's actually pretty cool. The other podcast that we recently started is called, before I jump ahead. Our podcast is effective because this gentleman here is Sharjeel, and he works for us. About 2 years ago, Sharjeel became disenfranchised with Islam. He went from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia. He studied with the imams. He studied the Quran and became a very conservative Muslim. But he started seeing the hypocrisy that, is inherent in Islam. I'm not trying to throw Muslims under the bus. There just are inconsistencies with the way that some people act and the way that some people say that, why they're acting that way. So as he started diving into the Quran, it started not making as much sense to him, and he got disillusioned and kind of walked away from Islam altogether. He came to the United States looking for, school opportunities, and he told his Uber driver, his Uber driver was a Muslim and said, "Are you a Muslim?" And he said, "I used to be a Muslim, but I don't believe that anymore." And he goes, "You know what? You should listen to this one podcast." So a Muslim Uber driver in Seattle told another Muslim about our podcast, and he connected with our podcast and called James, and James led him to the Lord. So a year and a half later, he works for us now. Our podcast is effective. The other podcast that we're doing is called the Christ and the Caliphate, right? So these are some of the topics we go over in Christ and the Caliphate. It's a little bit different because we are taking Muslim issues and things that happen in the Muslim world, whether it's in culture or politics or just the news in general, and showing Christians how to respond to that. Like, what is an adequate Christian response to the World Cup in Qatar, right? World Cup in Qatar was like a showcase for Islam. And people are showing up, in crusader costumes, right? The British were, yes, that was actually really interesting. So we talk about things like that in the podcast and kind of walk Christians through how to respond to what's going on. We also have this thing called Ask Almeida. Gosh, that slide did not fit in well. Ask Almeida is our newest series, and these are questions that Muslims email us about Christianity. So, why do Christians believe in the Trinity? And we're making these videos like short form, no more than 10 minutes. Try to keep it about 10 minutes or shorter to be able to answer these questions. These are going, these are gaining a lot of traction. These generate the most discussion online between Muslims and us in the comments. On section on YouTube. But the reason why they brought me on more recently is this thing called Operation Afghan Church Import. We were made aware of 120 Afghan Christians who were stuck in a refugee camp in Abu Dhabi. They were evacuated right before the fall of Afghanistan. The Taliban were coming to their houses and putting messages on their houses that said, "We are aware of your apostasy and you will pay for your crimes once the infidels leave." So the UNHRC came, gathered them up, and took them to Abu Dhabi, where they waited for a year. And because, they were there for so long and nobody really knew what to do with them because they're not Muslims, but they're surrounded by Muslims, and where do we actually send them? We found out about it. We raised $70,000 and processed all of their paperwork. We got all of their information and gathered it into one place and submitted it to the State Department. We were waiting for their applications to be processed, but what wound up happening was right at the end of the process, the United States government changed their status to a more protected status, which effectively took them out of the State Department system. They gave them into the care of the Jordanian government, and they kind of split them up. So some of them went to Canada, and some of them came to America. We currently have five families, and there are more trickling in every day. And my job as the coordinator of Afghan outreach is to oversee their well-being. This is our org chart. So yes, that is me in the corner wearing a Mongolian helmet because my boss has a sense of humor. And I oversee Sharjeel. I meet with Sharjeel and this other fellow called Cesar. Sharjeel's story you know. Cesar is a second generation Afghan Christian who we met in the camps, and he helped us gather all of the information from the refugees. Upon him coming here, we talked him into coming in and joining our staff. And my job is to oversee what they're doing and to help them develop the Christian character that they need to be able to be lights to these people. I'm not going to go into that. So a lot of why I do what I do, I've explained to you. And I believe it's important. And I believe it's important for us as Messianics, because what is the calling of the Jewish people? To be a light to the nations. It's the entire, like, everything in Isaiah, it's chapter 60 on, talks about this idea of all of the nations being drawn to the light of Jerusalem, to the light of the Messiah in these places. And I believe that God took me out of that to be able to be a light in this dark place. And this is where I'm really bad at this, guys. I'm not great at asking for support. But if you want to support me, you can see me after, or you know, we can talk about ways to do it. I have a newsletter that I'll put a sign-up sheet for, a newsletter that'll keep you posted on some of the daily comings and goings of ministry that happens in Almeida. I'm not, I haven't sprung this on you yet, but we'd love to come back and do, Almeida 101 and 102 with you. I know that you might be looking around, Central Arkansas and being like, there are not a lot of Muslims here. I was on the plane coming here, and I was like, there are a surprising amount of Muslims on this plane. So there are more than you think in any given area. And God wants to reach them too. They are the descendants of Abraham. They are what I call the heritage of Ishmael, the firstborn son. So if you look back in the book of Genesis, in chapter 16, the angel of the Lord makes a promise to Hagar about Ishmael. And the blessing that he gives him is not like the blessing that, Isaac gets, because Isaac's blessing is unique. Isaac gets the blessing of the firstborn, but the blessing that Ishmael gets is a lot like Abraham's blessing. It shows us that God isn't done with the descendants of Ishmael. In the 19th chapter of Isaiah, we see this like trinity of nations, this trio of nations coming together, Egypt, Assyria, and Israel. And it says that there'll be a blessing in the midst of the earth. There'll be a day of trouble for Egypt, but they'll call upon the name of the Lord. And a highway will be erected between Israel. Actually, we'll go back to that slide. A highway will be erected between Egypt and Israel and Assyria. And this is what's known as the Via Maris. It's the path of Abraham. It's everywhere where Abraham walked. Everywhere where God promised him. And that's where this highway will be at, this elevated highway, this way of connecting that will all be done. It's the extension of the Abrahamic covenant to the nations. Now, how can that happen? It only happens through Yeshua. This is part of God's plan for Messianic Judaism. This is part of God's plan for all believers, to make this part of the world a place where people are going to look for the living God. And the only way it can happen is when these nations call upon the name of Yeshua. So even though I'm involved in a Christian ministry, and even though I'm set my hand on this plow, I believe that that's my calling. And anything that you guys could do to support me, whether it be prayer, whether it be finances, whether it be just keeping up, would be welcome on my end. And I just thank you all for your time. I thank you for listening to the tired guy from New Jersey with the six kids. And I hope you're as blessed as I was. Thanks.